Charles Munch conducted the Boston Symphony for more than two decades, and during that time made a string of very famous recordings of classical music for RCA Records. My next guest, D. Kern Holloman, is a UC Davis music professor who has written the first English language biography of Munch, who was born in France, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, David. Nice to be here.
What prompted you undertaking this biography of somebody who is a known name, but not up there, you know, in the top tier, perhaps?
Well, the principal reason is that he figures as a kind of a villain in my previous book, because when the Paris Conservatory Orchestra, after the war, had to find its way, Munch was much more interested in achieving his international career. He was no longer a young man. He had a few decades left. So he wanted to leave Paris, and Paris didn't want him to leave. The other reason is that in 1968, when I was a conducting student and a music history student at Duke University, we went off to hear the new Orchestre de Paris under Charles Munch, which was his last appointment. And he conducted Berlioz and Ravel and Samuel Barber that night, and the next day he died in Richmond. So I happened to have been at his last concert, and that's Wade. And he was a model for me as a young conductor. So it weighed heavily, and I thought, someday I want to write about this man.
And why isn't he as well known as von Karajan or Bernstein or Carl Böhm?
Well, for two different reasons. One is that he was a very modest man. He was a sober, quiet individual, sober in a philosophical way, a quiet man, and not especially interested in those kinds of questions. Additionally, his wife died very in the 50s, and he had no children. So there was really nobody to create the Munch legend, whereas Bernstein and Karajan in particular left behind large public relations companies and enterprises, and you know, every moment of their last several years was preserved on tape or on video. Mm-hmm. And Toscanini had a family of hagiographers, so Munch simply didn't have somebody to come along behind him and do all of that. That said, the discography is remarkable. People don't understand how much music they know because of those RCA recordings from the early stereo days. Hmm. The entire French repertoire, Mendelssohn, Brahms, like that.
And so it was because he went in and performed or conducted those pieces that they became known to the general public? They weren't well known before that?
Oh, sure. For one thing, when he first started conducting, the French composer Roussel said, won't you help me make a work of my ballet, an orchestral work of my ballet, Bacchus and Ariadne, and that's a famous work now. Munch was the brain behind, the musician brain behind the Berlioz revival in the 50s and 60s, the French composer Dutilleux, and then the whole French repertoire, César Franck and like that. He was one of two major French conductors, the other one being Pierre Monteux, practicing in the United States. And, you know, after the war, people didn't much want to have a lot to do with German conductors. And so the two French conductors had carte blanche to make a go of it.
Well, let's listen to a little piece that this is Charles Munch conducting the Symphonie Fantastique by Hector Berlioz, sorry. I'm speaking with D. Kern Holloman, who just wrote the first English language biography of conductor Charles Munch. You're conducting.
Either way, actually. There's a wonderful story about that excerpt just there, which is that this is the first movement he rehearsed with the new Orchestre de Paris in 1967. And because he had come back from retirement to do this, this is on television and highly photographed, and André Malraux, the Minister of Arts, was there, and so on and so on. And Munch looks out while the fiddle players are having some difficulty with the opening event in this movement, and he says, what kind of violins do you have? And they held up their violins. He said, because in Boston we had 12 Stradivarius. Do you have Stradivarius? And they all look and they nod negatively. And he said, well, we'll do the best we can anyway. So about these stereo recordings. So the Damnation of Faust in 1953-54, someplace in there, was the very first classical music recording where they actually tried to do stereo. It was not published in stereo at the beginning, but they double taped it. They taped it in mono upstairs and downstairs for the Cognoscenti. They were trying the stereophonic recording system for the first time, and that turned into RCA Living Stereo.
So when they did that, they recorded mono in two different places because you would be getting a different sound in those two different places, but they would still be synced up?
No. They had a complete mono recording studio on upstairs in Symphony Hall, and downstairs they had a second setup with the extra microphone where they were actually experimenting with how they might do this. This is before there was any widely available hardware for the public, commercial hardware, to actually play it back. They didn't know what they were going to sell when it was over. They just wanted to make the sound work.
Oh, okay. And then when were those released much later?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then quite quickly they were doing everything in stereo. But it was just mm-hmm. five people at RCA and three orchestras. And so it took a while to get going.
What is the overarching characteristic of a great, not just a good conductor, but a great conductor?
Well, what I argue in this book is I think a great conductor has to be most interested in music at the moment that in live performance, even more than in recording, he has to be rebuilding the piece from scratch. This is a period where where the notion of fidelity to the score was kicking in, and Toscanini kept saying you have to be faithful to the score. I don't think that Munch was actually faithful to the printed score. I think he had committed the printed score to memory decades before. And when you watch him work, there's a lot of video now, when you watch him work, what you see is this man who knew every nuance of how Brahms first goes, rebuilding it in his mind and then conveying it to the musicians so that this piece that, after all, the Boston Symphony had played Brahms first 400, 500, 600 times under Charles Munch, make it new again, make it interesting again, make it of the moment. And he was a genius at that. I think one of the best.
I'm speaking with D. Kern Holloman, who just wrote the first book in the English language of Charles Munch. Biographies often end up being more interesting to a larger audience if there's some personal aspects of the person. Do you talk much about his life beyond music, or do you focus pretty much on music?
Oh, sure.
Because
it makes it sound like he's
not so much.
One of the things that's fascinating about this man is that first he led the Orchestre de Paris through the occupation in Paris. And therefore he was dealing with the Nazi authorities all the time. He was binational. He spoke both German and French from the beginning. And that's a fascinating story. A second fascinating story is the fact that his marriage was a complex one. He had lots of girlfriends, and one of them still alive, but two of them are very significant sources for this book. So you get a certain amount of romance in the book. And I think also you get a great deal of what it was like to try to reconcile the German and French cultures, Beethoven and Brahms and Bach. The Munches go back to Bach. The Munches are interrelated by family with the Schweitzers and people in the governing, also with Jean-Paul Sartre. So they're the cream of the crop, intellectually, fiscally, very, very wealthy people. Munch married the Nestle estate, so he had all the Nestle money. He could buy anything he wanted. He had paintings and etchings and little statues worth gazillions of francs. So it's a fascinating story, quite apart from Berlioz and Beethoven and Brahms, I think.
Well, the book is Charles Munch. Say it for me, would you please?
Either way, he says Charles Munch. His friends called him Shari for Charlie. But in Leipzig, where he began, he was called Karl Munch. So you're perfectly right.
Okay, well, I'll just wander all over the place. But D. Kern Holloman, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Good luck with the book. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Sea of Bees.